One of the velociraptors I had that had really badly degraded, it was just the head that was left. For a while, there were hornets nesting in it, and a bird had nested. There were like birds came out of its mouth, which was very poetic. And so I took this head and I brought it as they were doing Jurassic World. And I wanted to impress upon one of the producers there that you could do something accurate with dinosaurs and don't make them what's wrong then, and certainly wrong now for information we have. But mostly, you know, what was so great about, I thought, the best part about Jurassic Park as a movie was that it had some sense of wonder about the dinosaurs rather than just being sort of instruments of terror, which they seem to become in the later Jurassic Park movies. So there was this guy, I think his name's Patrick Crawley. He's one of the producers.
Yeah, that's not great.
His name. And I hadn't met him, but, you know, Kathy Kennedy and somebody else recommended me to go see him. So I walk into this guy's office with the head of the Velociraptor. He said, you know, I have a present for you. And I thought he'd be appreciative. He didn't say anything. And then I said, so here's what I want to talk to you about. Can I explain that? And he said, why should I listen to you? What the hell are you doing here telling me this? And get out of my office. Screaming at me. So I just left the Velociraptor head on the table there. And then I got a note from Kathy Kennedy later, apologizing that this guy was a doofus, and saying that it turned out that the Velociraptor head was infested with ants. They had gotten all over Crawley's office. So I was really happy.
That's great. He deserved it then, in that case.
That's right. So I had no association with any of the recent ones, but they did hire a guy now, who's a Steve Brissett, to be the science advisor, who's a very good young scientist and was like a Jurassic Park fanboy when he was young.
Yeah.
I hope they listen to him because he's a good guy.
Well, I don't know if they really listened to him very much because, well, what are your thoughts on the Jurassic World movies?
And they just strayed so far from what it was that it's just like, to me, it's another fantasy movie. They're not bad. Yeah. There's a lot worse.
Yeah.
But I don't even, it doesn't even stir my loyalty to the franchise. Kind of, you know, it still bugs me that they haven't updated the dinosaurs.
I actually know of a lot of Jurassic Park fans, you know, that do love the original movies, but they also do want to see more realistic dinosaurs portrayed. I think the only way the first Jurassic World movie kind of explains it, like, it's kind of like a, you know, blink and you'll miss it kind of line, where Dr. Wu mentions how that they wanted to make more realistic dinosaurs, but they didn't want realism. You know, they just wanted more teeth, or, you know, just something that people, you know, wanted or expected to see.
Right.
So, I mean, that kind of was a nice way to simply, I guess, explain that, but, you know, I think it went over most people's heads, and it doesn't really help, honestly.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's so many things beyond just the concept of putting dinosaurs back together that are bogus about that idea. You know, even in the movie, it's totally unconvincing that they're making dinosaurs come back to life, especially using frog DNA. And I once asked Crichton, you know, like, this doesn't make any sense. He said, yeah, I know, I had to skip some things because I didn't know how to do it either. You know, if they were brought back to life, why would they live? You know, as soon as we saw Native Americans, we killed them with our breath, you know?
Yeah.
So they're all these germs they're not exposed to, they're all these alkaloid plants that would poison them. Why are you spending all this money to bring back them when, you know, the mammoth you could much more easily bring back to life? So it's just the movie, when you really look closely, is, which from a science point of view, I did at the time, and that has since certainly gotten over because it's much more about the inspiration that the science draws from it. There are a lot of people who became scientists, but, you know, the Dilophosaurus is 20 feet long. It doesn't fit. There's no dinosaur that's fat. They took the frill from a Australian lizard. The T-Rex couldn't catch a car in second gear. It could see you when you stood still. I could sniff you and eat you. It would have eaten the whole lawyer and the toilet bowl in that scene because it could eat that much in one bite. And I like to think that lawyers and dinosaurs are closely related. So, predatory dinosaurs. Compsognathus is undersized, the compies. So it's like dinosaurs on steroids, and they don't bear that much resemblance. The T-Rex is actually pretty reasonable, I think. But, the Velociraptor, what's his name, Muldoon, the guy with the shorts? He's like, they're as smart as chimpanzees, they're as fast as cheetahs, and they can remember. So in the factual version, they're as smart as an ostrich among the dumbest of birds. They're about as fast as a poodle, and they're the same size. And they don't remember much. So I wouldn't be so scared of that. Velociraptor is relatively smart for a dinosaur. Its bird intelligence is pretty good. But the dinosaur that was already known that was the size of a person in a suit, which is pretty much the size they are in the movie, that would be Deinonychus. The Utah Raptor was the size of an ice cream truck, and so it was a pretty scary animal, and it lived long before these guys. And yes, it was discovered in the time that they're making it. And Bakker, who kind of stole the thunder of the guy who actually worked on it, Jim Kirkland, wanted to name it Spielbergosaurus to get attention from Spielberg. And Spielberg said, I don't want to, he had already said he didn't want to die, so I named that from. So that's how it ended up, Utah Raptor. And then Bakker wrote Raptor Red, that book? Yeah, and he pretty much took all of Kirkland's research and didn't credit him. So in my book that I had written about all the researchers, I kind of presented everything about these people, what people would celebrate about Bakker. He was very inventive and entertaining, and he helped to change the view of dinosaurs, as well as what was critical about him, that he stole specimens and research and whatever else. And so he was not happy about the book because he was very much about his PR. And then we both worked on the dinosaur ride at Animal Kingdom.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask about that.
So I met him and I said, look, it's been a bunch of years, like, why don't we bury the hatchet? And he said, go fuck yourself. So I think we get the hatchet is still there.
Wow. So what was it like working for Disney's Animal Kingdom? I actually finally got to visit there for the first time last year, and it's amazing, and the ride, and the dinosaur ride is amazing. I still think so anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't go on it because it's really scary.
Yeah,
But
it is.
people love it. They are, Disney is its own thing. They're obsessed with detail and getting it right and the backstory for everything. It's kind of cool. It's a little bit like a cult. But when the manhole covers have Mickey's head on them, that they're going over the top. It was a lot of fun because, well, first of all, working on it, there wasn't that, again, not that much to do. They did create like the largest arboretum there. You wouldn't even know it is one, next to the Institute of Jurassic era plants. Quite expensive and everything else, just for the sake of doing the right thing. So that's very cool. At that time, early on, they had a bunch of skeletons that they displayed in a little temporary display. Oh, this is one interesting story, but it didn't have very much to do with the movie, but I was an advisor on the dinosaurs movie. And so I went to the building where they were did the animation and stuff, and they're working on several projects at the same time. So I walk in, and there's a chimpanzee and a diaper running around the building.
What?
What's happening here? And they said, well, we're making Tarzan, and the animators wanted to have a chance to observe an animal live. So we rented a chimpanzee, and he's running around the building. And then the director was a very nice woman. I've forgotten her name. And we were talking, and I said, could you just do me a favor? Don't kill the parents in the first 2 minutes and traumatize my children like every other Disney movie. And she said, nope. And then I said, look, you got all these dinosaurs like Carnotaurus and a bunch of other guys who were randomly chosen from all these time periods. It wouldn't hurt anything to just choose a whole bunch of South American dinosaurs that were contemporaries of Carnotaurus in the Cretaceous. And that would be cool because it would be a real community that existed. And she said, nope. I said, why not? She said, because we're Disney and we don't have to.
I guess that's the answer.
Yeah. She was actually a very nice person, so she, you know, it's tongue in cheek, but it's also true. And then you're never supposed to mention that you ever worked for Disney. You have to sign something that says that you never worked for them. So clearly I don't abide by that.
Oh no, they're gonna come after you now.
That's right, they're gonna come and get me. And so no, I never went on the ride until.
So was that the extent of your work on the movie too then? You were the advisor for the movie as well?
Yeah. There was so little to do for an animated movie, you know. I'm just glad that they didn't sing. So I was somewhat helpful, but not very, in finding artists, not for doing animation, but to base their animals off of. So, you know, they were very interested in the people then, some of whom they already knew, but they knew Hollywood guy who's been involved in some. Oh, Bill Stout, who's a very good illustrator. But they didn't really know so much about Don Civic and Doug Hallett and Don Gerchy, who were really the premier illustrators. So pointing out all these people and their work was somewhat useful. Unfortunately, they paid me just about as much as I was worth. So they are quite a cheap bunch of people there. But on the other hand, they did this great thing, which there's a guy who's been a long time in charge of creative stuff there, Joe Rohde. And he was overseeing this project. And so he invited, before the park opened, all the people who had some creative input into it of any kind. So the dinosaur people, Bakker and I, the woman who was a fundraiser to create the charity. You know, there's a conservation institute that you give a buck to if you want to when you go in.
Yeah.
And the woman devised this thing where you donate, Disney collects all the money, and then Disney gets the tax deduction. So it wasn't her idea. I'm hearing this directly because I met this woman and then I married her. So I got a great thing out of it. And she got her best friend, who was a kind of blue sky illustrator for Disney. So that was a great benefit of working on it.
That's so crazy that just like involved on that movie led to that for you.
I know. And it was such a cool bunch of people because they really were a random assortment. The woman who did the narration for the Jeep ride with a South African accent, and the painter who did murals. And so it was a really interesting bunch of people and really fun to hang out with. And I think the reason that we got to see it first was before they opened it to the public, they wanted the people who might get killed if something went wrong to be people under contract so we our heirs couldn't sue them. I can't think of any other reason why they'd want us there. But,
What did you think of the movie for Dinosaur?
It was fun. I mean, it's so removed from this. I actually think it was better than, you know, it's not really remembered as a movie.
Yeah, it's the same. I think a lot of people consider it like, oh, it's just like Land Before Time. But I mean, you know, it's more realistic version, I guess. The Carnotaurus is a lot cooler. It's a shame. Although I think why a lot of people don't like it or didn't like it at the time was because there was all this hype built up before it where originally the dinosaurs weren't going to talk.
Right.
So I think people got upset by that. With The Lost World, how involved were you with that film?
Not. other than doing the exhibit, I wrote to David Kep, who had written the first one and was writing the second one, and said, can you leave Spinosaurus out of this and you Giganotosaurus? It's a cooler dinosaur. You know, I wanted to promote the dinosaur I was associated with. And he didn't like that at all. So... I don't know if that was, but I really, you know, nobody asked, but I wouldn't have worked on it. There was no reason to, you know, like I had already had the experience, which was great, but you know, it just would have been a worse script to deal with, which it was. and a less convincing dinosaur story. And so there would be no real attraction to it. And plus, I still couldn't allow myself to be paid. So, there were other things I could be doing. Jack Horner was the central advisor, and he stayed involved, and he, they donated some money to the Museum of the Rockies. But he's dyslexic. I don't think he ever read the script. And he never suggested anything about what they should do with it. So I think he was just happy to hang out when they were making it, and then get a donation for his work, which was really important research.
No, I think I read somewhere that he was dyslexic, which was surprising to me. So it's interesting.
Yeah, he flunked out of school, I think, 7 times. I wrote a children's biography of him, and then we collaborated on a book too. But he never even read the book that we wrote together about T-Rex being a scavenger.
Oh, yeah.
I said, "Do you read this stuff?" He said, "No, but I want to make an argument." And then we had like 3 or 4 dinners together, and then the rest of it, I tried to make it sound like he was talking. And he never read it. I don't think he even knows what he supposedly said in the book, but I
Oh
just
my goodness.
amplified his theories and a whole lot of information about T-Rex, and that became the book.
You have written over 50 books throughout the years, including, some for National Geographic. And one of my favorites when I was growing up in 1996 was called Raptors, the Nastiest Dinosaurs. Yeah, I don't know if you remember that one, but that was the one I remember the most.
I do.
Yeah.
I remember a lot of them by the illustrator or whatever, who is, I think it was David Peters. But anyway, that was kind of fun, because usually publishers don't let you get involved in choosing the illustrators. But for whatever reason, I got to, and so I would try and use different people that I liked their work. So that was the fun for me.
No, that's great. I never realized that they didn't like usually allow the authors to choose the illustrators. You think it would be like you'd want their advice to get their vision across as best as possible. So that's interesting.
No, they have what they call, that shows how much they think of them, a stable of illustrators who they know are reliably priced and deliver the stuff on time. And that's who they usually use. But if you can package a book, and do everything, design, illustration, whatever, then you can control it. I do that sometimes, but not for that book.
There's a feature on your website, on your Dino Don website, that's called Ask Dino Don. Like, what are some of the most frequent questions you get asked?
Well, the heyday of this was I did it for Highlights magazines, and the one in the dentist's office that's been basically the same since the 1930s, but they added a dinosaur column, and kids used to write letters, so I got 11,000 letters, and I had to answer every one, which was fun actually, because they're often the same question, so I would have an answer and I would write D21, which was the answer, and then somebody in the Highlights office would put that together with the rest of the text that had something personal for me and create the letter. So it wasn't as onerous as it sounds, but it was interesting to see which things were most on the minds of kids. You can imagine what extincted the dinosaurs, as they would say. What color were they? And the answer used to be, we have no idea. And of course we do. Were they warm-blooded? We used to say we had no idea. And could T-Rex beat Spinosaurus?
Oh no, that's part
And
two.
the best one was, so there's a picture of me, like with just a little picture with the story that ran. And some kid wrote me and said, "My mom is single. Would you be interested in dating her?" So I think this kid thought, I can get a dad who is a dinosaur fan like me. And then there's another one that said, "Do you use your mustache to brush off the fossils?" Those are my favorites.
How could they not be?
Right.
We mentioned before how you discovered Argentinosaurus and Giganotosaurus. Like, what, how did all that happen?
The two giant dinosaurs I did not discover, but I was responsible for excavating and reconstructing. What happened was I went to a conference. What happened was I would go every fall for the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology conference, which is about as boring as it sounds. But students would do poster sessions, little presentations on boards about what it is that they were doing, which was really cool research that you wouldn't know about otherwise. And the research, the more senior researchers like Horner and others, would preview what was later going to appear in a paper. So you would find out first about a new discovery before, long before it would have gotten in a newspaper or even a scientific journal. So I was going to one of these poster sessions and walking past all these boards of different guys, and I stopped at one because there was a Polaroid kind of picture of a huge femur, and you could tell the shape of a theropod, a meat eater, bone. I said, this is the biggest femur of any carnivore ever. I said, yeah, so what? That was like, size wasn't his interest, you know, that's a popular obsession, mine too. And so he said, well, I'm excavating this dinosaur. I run a local museum in Patagonia. His name is Rodolfo Coria. And I don't have enough money to finish it. And I think there's a whole dinosaur in there. So I said, well, what's it going to take? He said, that's probably $6,000. So I thought, even I can get together $6,000. But at that time, I didn't have $6,000. So I knew from Spielberg, his friend of his did CD-ROMs, and the guy liked dinosaurs, and his kid was in kindergarten with one of Spielberg's kids. So I knew this guy. I said, can you give me $6,000? We'll promote your CD-ROM, and we'll use it on this thing. So he did, and so we excavated the dinosaur. It turned out to be the one and only Giganotosaurus, and it was more than 80% complete, which is really rare. And so then it needed to be cleaned. And, you know, just missing parts sculpted, the rest of it molded and cast. And so I brought a whole crew there, including a woman from L.A., then in her 80s, who was the master caster of all dinosaurs, has unfortunately just died. And so this little 80-pound woman would come down, and in Argentina they had no good, you know, silicone to use. So she would have to bring all this stuff with her. So she was an 80-pound person carrying 80 pounds of stuff. And then she set up a lab there in the middle of nowhere, Patagonia. And because the bones themselves are never allowed to leave the country, they have to remain there. So we had to do everything to bring the cast to the U.S., create the armature there, and put it all together for Atlanta. And the first place to show it was, I'm sorry, the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. At the same time, they had already excavated some bones of Argentinosaurus. So when I got down there with Phil Curry, who's a very good paleontologist and ended up a collaborator, we went to see the site of the Argentinosaurus. All at that point was known of it was a couple of backbones, a couple of leg bones. And in the end, they didn't find much more. My daughter with us, and she found another backbone. So this is the biggest bone in the world. I was pretty excited, and she was too. And we showed it to Coria, and he goes, God damn it. So what's the matter? He said, well, we already have one exactly like it, but now we're obligated to dig this one up. It's going to take us 2 months. It weighs 2 tons. I have to use jackhammers just to get something that's exactly the same as what we already have. So I'm going to the bar and get drunk. That was the upshot of having found the biggest bone. So that dinosaur, because of its size and the little amount of real material, which is actually very typical. 10% is a lot, but that's all we had. So we had to do a lot of modeling using smaller sauropods of related titanosaurids and scaling it up. So that was a much bigger challenge in every way. But I thought, I really want to do the scene of Argentinosaurus and Giganotosaurus. Even though they're off by a little bit of time, but it's a very close relative, since found Mapplesaurus, that really was a contemporary. So I wanted to have them face off, and there was a museum in Atlanta, the Fernbank Museum, and they had a huge atrium that was empty, in this new museum. And so I said to somebody there, you know, that would be great to put these dinosaurs in there. So I got Bob Walters, who was a very good dinosaur illustrator, to create a drawing of what it would look like. And I sent it to the museum. And I didn't hear anything. I wasn't expecting to necessarily. And then I got a call from the Atlanta Constitution newspaper saying, so when will the sculpture be finished? And I thought, there's something missing here, but I have to play like I know what's going on. So I said, well, you know, it'll take a little while. And how did you learn about it? And so apparently the museum had decided to go ahead with it, had told the newspaper, but never bothered to tell me.
Lovely.
I know. So it was about 2 years of work to finish it. And we had a very dynamic pose for the tail in a curve, you know, a curve can go in more than one direction. But skeletons are made, the armatures with iron, and it's very hard to weld iron to go in more than one direction. Aluminum can, but we didn't know how to weld aluminum. So we were getting very close to the finish date, but no idea how we were going to finish. Fortunately, one of the museum's trustees was a guy who had an aluminum welding workshop. So it saved our ass. And the result is it's a really cool pose of the tail of the Argentinosaur. Probably a little too long, but that's another question.
So the company that you own that creates these animatronic dinosaurs for exhibits is called Dino Don Inc. And you have almost 20
Yes.
different species now.
Oh, more than that. So we custom make them until we have such a large inventory that we'll be reusing them in places. So, and it's not just dinosaurs. So what I try to do is theme the exhibitions first and then create the dinosaurs to match the theme or other animals. So we're doing one in Philadelphia that got postponed to next year at the zoo, where it's evolution and extinction. So it starts before dinosaurs and it ends with, you know, very recently extinct animals. So basically anything bigger than 6 feet you can make a robot out of that moves a little bit at least.
Yeah.
And but you know, my interest in it was I went to the best dinosaur quarry in the world only 3 years ago. I always wanted to go and never did. It's in Sichuan, China, and it was discovered in the 1950s by a gas company, and they have giant plant eaters like Lamentosaurus, the guy you saw in the exhibit, and it looks like they just tipped over the skeleton because they're so complete. So that's how we know that some of these big sauropods actually had tail clubs, or there are like only 20 sauropod skulls in the world and a good percentage of them in that one quarry. So I always wanted to go, and I went, and it turns out that in that town is where they make all the robot dinosaurs practically in the world. So I went to the factory to see how it's done, and I was surprised that there's no mold. I always hated robot dinosaurs because they're worse than Jurassic Park dinosaurs for accuracy, like half size and clunky. And I saw that they're just doing it because somebody told them to do it. And they're little old ladies with foam like couch cushion material, carving the shape of a dinosaur and then putting skin over them and an armature underneath. So I thought, okay, if I bring a scientist here to supervise the carving, I took actually a guy who used to work on Jurassic Park for Stan Winston to go look at the motors, see if we could put some stronger motors in there, because a big robot dinosaur is actually usually powered by the same motor that turns a windshield wiper. That's how underpowered they are. So they burn up a lot. So I said, okay, we remake the insides, we remake the outsides, we make them full size, because right now all the robots that were out there were maxed out at like T-Rex size. But there's no reason why you can't make them in sections and make them as big as they get, 120 feet. So started remaking them and bought some for myself to tour if they worked. Once we knew that, then I started selling them to zoos and renting them. So we started with the Bronx Zoo about a year and a half ago. And now we've, a few things have been postponed, but we'll have about 10 shows to 20 shows next year. And that means, you know, a couple hundred dinosaurs.
Oh my God.
I know.
That's very exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, we did Ice Age Animals one place. We actually now just opened an exhibit at the Houston Zoo of dragons.
Oh, nice.
Dragons of different cultures.
That's pretty crazy. You were once the creator and founder of a theme park that was going to be built called EarthQuest Adventures.
Yeah.
What was that going to be like?
Was awesome. It really was. I chose to work on, well, so the concept was to create a sustainability-themed theme park. So at the core, the very center of it, was an institute devoted to daily living and how to make it more energy efficient. And to have a community that was like a, like Epcot was the prototype community of tomorrow, you know? This was, to be more realistically, how people could live in a community that would minimize their need for energy use, how it would monitor the trash consumption, all kinds of things. And the institute in the center would be producing the energy for it with kind of, you know, using algae blooms and all kinds of other bio-generated energy. And you could go in the institute and you could monitor, like in the control room, how the whole park is being operated. So you could see like the guts of it all. And then the surrounding of it was what would have been geographically the second biggest theme park in America, next to only to Disney World. And it was a $600 million project. I chose for designers a sort of boutique group of ex-Disney VPs who I knew who were very creative, and they really greatly elaborated on the concept. You know, the standard theme park rule was obeyed, which is you got to have this big thing in the middle that everybody can see so they don't get lost. You got to have different realms, five or six different areas themed, each one having an e-ticket, you know, like a high-end ride and some little kid ride and things in between. And they were, so they thought of ways to repurpose a lot of existing technologies to keep it from being hugely expensive. I mean, you could spend $600 million on one ride in Universal. So, but it was a very diverse attraction. The way it was themed was cool. You went, there was a section devoted to dinosaurs in their world, but there was also there was a surrounding zoo, like the Animal Kingdom kind of zoo, but with different habitats. And I included in it that there would be these luxury tree houses over the animal enclosure. That's where I was going to live, so I was quite excited about that. And then there was around that there's another buffer that was just free recreation, fishing and you know, so it would really be a magnet for people. And this is outside Houston, where there's nothing to do, and a fairly prosperous population, and a lot of people in the middle of the country. And even in Mexico, who were not going to travel to either coast to go to a theme park. So, had a lot going for it. And we spent about $7 million developing it, which was money that came from the local development corporation of the town, New Caney. But the partners in this, who owned the land and sort of oversaw the whole project, were in charge of raising the money. First of all, I had no idea what they were doing. They hired a guy who was going to go to celebrities and get them to donate, to invest. So he was going to chase Oprah Winfrey. Anyway, that didn't work. But the underlying part of this is that those guys were crooks. They never even owned the land.
Oh, great.
They and the local development corporation had never fully investigated that these guys just had a lease on the land. So. They were also the same guys who were developing some miracle water that they claimed the local MD Anderson, famous cancer lab in Houston, had blessed as being a cure. So they were really charlatans, because of course it didn't, and MD Anderson too. But there was so little homework done about this team of developers that was really a waste of effort of a lot of very talented people. You know, we had economic analysis about the return on investment done by a guy who'd won a Nobel Prize, and all these Disney people, and you know, beautiful storyboarding and stuff. It was great, but did not. So it's the guys who designed it ended up with the IP, and they're still trying to hawk it as a theme park. So you can go online and see it, the whole layout, earthquestadventures.com and earthquestinstitute.org. But never came to pass.
How'd your interest in Genghis Khan come about?
Well, my initial interest in dinosaurs when I was a kid, it was a long time ago. The books that were out there were by this guy, Roy Chapman Andrews. And he had been the president of the American Museum, but before that, he was an explorer, and he was the first guy to go and look for fossils in the Gobi Desert in the 1920s. And it was his team from the American Museum that found the Velociraptor, as well as the first nest of dinosaur eggs. And he is actually the real-life model of Indiana Jones. Like, Spielberg would deny that there was any one character, but, I mean, this guy was an explorer in open cars, wearing leather jackets and hats. He was afraid of snakes. He carried a revolver. And how much more do you need to be?
Yeah, exactly.
Indiana Jones. Anyway, I read these adventures, and particularly there was a book called Under a Lucky Star about his adventures in Mongolia. It turned out they were maybe 50% bullshit. Like, he would say, oh, I was attacked by brigands, and then I was shot in the foot. Well, there are two separate things. One was he was attacked by some robbers. The second is that he was cleaning his gun and he shot himself in the foot. So he was actually shot in the foot, but it was by himself. So, anyway, I didn't know all that as a kid, and I was fascinated. And one of the dinosaur exploration adventures that I went on was, for the first time since practically that time, the Soviets had taken over Mongolia, a Western team was allowed to go look for dinosaurs. And the goal was to retrace the steps of Roy Chapman Andrews and follow his own maps and see what more dinosaurs could be found. So I went on that exploration. And there are probably three things in Mongolia that are famous in the rest of the world. One is dinosaurs. The other might be their kind of underpants wrestling, because the sumo champions are Mongolian. And the third would be Genghis Khan. Other than that, people don't know anything about Mongolia, myself included. So when I got there, to my mind, he was a horrific barbarian. Well, you get there, and he's like the combination to them of Lincoln, Washington, and Roosevelt, you know, all in, and Jesus, all in one. Because he turned this least populated in density country in the world into the biggest empire four times over that the world ever knew. He created their language. He created the country. He's the reason we have forks and paper money and passports and violins and lemons and diplomatic immunity and arguably libraries and national parks. I mean, so much of the things that we take to be Western civilization were actually things he brought from the East. And, you know, even his way of governing was much more democratic than ours. So I felt like this was a revelation, and it would be so cool to make an exhibition using real artifacts from his time and tell the story of his life, which is amazing in itself. I mean, he was an outcast in a small, illiterate tribe, so as backward as he could possibly be. And yet he had this concept. He wrote the laws of his kingdom even before he was a Khan. So he somehow envisaged this whole thing, and the magnetism to draw all these people to it. This totally self-effacing guy who wanted to be called by his first name and never dressed up. And we have accounts that are only rediscovered about 100 years ago, but a very accurate telling of his life. Called A Secret History. So we actually know a lot about him. He was afraid of dogs, and he was afraid of his mother. you know, so he's just a very dynamic character that you could tell a life story of, from his that humble origin to not only his son creating sort of the first capital, but then to Kublai Khan, his grandson, ending up creating a real Xanadu and, you know, unifying China for the first time. So it made it for a hell of an exhibit, and it's still touring. It's been touring since 2009.
Wow.
which is very rare. And we sometimes have mummies in it, or and always have a couple hundred things. It's probably the largest collection of artifacts from his time anywhere, because he was not a collector of things. There's very little that's actually from his time. And then we have live performance in it, because the Mongolian culture is the same as it was then, except that people ride motorcycles instead of horses. But really, and they all have solar dishes and watch CNN and know more about our politics than we do.
I believe
But
it.
yeah, and they're the most literate nation in the world. But they still revere him, and they sing the same songs that were sung before him, the whole oral tradition and the dancing and the contortionism that they do, and we have performers doing the exhibit. And the same things he would have seen. And the dwelling is pretty much the same Europe as he would have lived in. So, it's kind of celebrating that, and it's the last horse-based culture in the world. So there's a chance to like promote Mongolia. There isn't a lot promoting Mongolia out there.
Growing up, I remembered reading a 1994 issue of Boys Life magazine, and there was an article that detailed your top five favorite dinosaurs.
I don't even remember that.
You don't remember that?
No.
That's a nice pictures. It's a dreamy, of course.
What were they? What were they?
Yeah, they were Velociraptor, Mayasaura, Amargasaurus, Troodon, and Tyrannosaurus Rex. So my question for you was, is that still your top five now, or would you change
No, I would change that.
that?
Number one has to be Lesimosaurus because it's named after me. So,
Oh, really?
yeah. And, a paper showed up on my doorstep one day from an Argentine journal, which is in Spanish, but they would have a little summary paragraph at the top anyways. And I thought, I don't subscribe to this thing. Why the hell did I get this? And then I'm leafing through it, and there's a story about Argentine paleontologists, so they want to part their names. Lesimosaurus after American philanthropist Don Lesim. So he had mistakenly thought that it was my money that funded the Jurassic Foundation. So he thought if I name a dinosaur after this guy, he's going to give me a lot of money. So he was very disappointed to learn that I didn't have any of that money. The dinosaur turned out to be a fairly significant dinosaur because it's a link between prosauropods and sauropods in its vertebral structure. And since that initial discovery, they've found three individuals. And so my big fear was if I would be invalidated because half all the dinosaurs' names have been thrown out over time. So I didn't want to be thrown out. So now there's enough data to indicate that it's not a dubious name, so I will survive. So that's my favorite dinosaur. Troodon is up there because it's the smartest, and I long wanted to write a book, A Watershed Down of Dinosaurs. So that's two. There's so many new ones. There's one called Khan, so I have to be a supporter. Named after Genghis Khan. Oh boy, it's a question. Oh, I like Orodromius because I like the idea of a dinosaur digging up holes. That's four. And I guess Argentinosaurus because it's the bulk. That's one of the great things about dinosaurs. I mean, this is 10 times bigger than anything ever, including T-Rex, before or since. So I'm really interested in how it's engineered, and I don't believe that Patagotitan or anybody else is any bigger than that, but it's big enough. I'm working on a documentary series about how we make the dinosaurs, the robots in China, and all the knuckleheads, myself included, who are involved in it, and with a producer who's made, we used to run the Discovery Channel, so I think it'll end up getting made, but you never know. Dinosaur Factory, so give it 10 months,
I'll definitely
I
be on the
think.
lookout for it for sure.
Right.
Well, Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I mean, this has been amazing.
Thanks. It's my pleasure. It's nice to talk to somebody who cares that much.
Jurassic Time would like to thank Dino Don Lessem for his time and engaging insight behind the curtain of the world of the dinosaurs. We hope you have enjoyed this insightful conversation of his many accomplishments and involvements. Be sure to like and subscribe to see more of Jurassic Time's exploration of Jurassic Park's hidden histories.